Buchanan with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 105 and the second episode of 2023. Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gonge-Rujic and Peter Galindo as 2023 keeps on rolling. Canadian soccer keeps on rolling as well. We'll get into this episode, but don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, follow on social. We're on every platform that you can possibly imagine. So make sure to interact with us and rate us on there. Peter, Alex, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. I am now once again continuing my world tour, and I'm in Vancouver now. I just seem to be avoiding Toronto these days. It's not because of you guys, I swear, though.
Mr. Worldwide.
You've been gone so long, you started saying Toronto, not Toronto.
That's true. I have been gone for a while. I've been hanging out with too many Irish people who pronounce both T's.
Doing great. Enjoying the Eastern time zone. Enjoying Toronto. Enjoying everything else that has to offer. True Toronto men's right there. But no, you know how it is. We're moving along here. We're moving along. A lot going on. So it's been good.
And with that, we'll get into our Canucks Abroad roundup and mailbag with all of your questions. And it's been a busy week of the final week of the January transfer window as well. But a reminder that Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules detailing Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. Alfonso Davies and Bayern Munich were back in action in a 1-1 draw with RB Leipzig. Davies went 81 minutes in their 1-1 draw with Cologne on Tuesday. Jonathan David went 89 minutes for Lille in their 2-0 win over Didi Nabsi's Pau in the Coupe de France on Sunday. David had three shots with an expected goals of 0.36 and two key passes. And we'll get to our first question now from Canucks Abroad at Canucks_abroad. Transfermarkt seems to suggest that the EPL is the only destination for Jonathan David. Is there any chance at all that he could transfer to another top five European league? Borussia Mönchengladbach seems quite unlikely now given his quality, even though they desperately need a striker.
I don't really think it has so much to do with his quality per se, but rather just the asking price from Lille. Because if you look at what they're quoting with 2 and a bit years left on his contract, they've been quoting in and around 50 to 60 million euros for David for a while now, which for the most part prices him out of a move to most clubs outside of England, save for Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, PSG, clubs of that stature. We know he probably isn't going to PSG or Madrid unless something drastic changes, but he was an option for Bayern in the summer when Lewandowski left. That was, I believe, according to Bild at the time. And they could still use a number nine now, really, but the wages plus the allure of the Premier League, that might be too much to overcome for Bayern or another prospective club outside of England. And it sure sounds like David really does have his heart set on the Premier League anyways.
Yeah, I think statistically, fit-wise, profile-wise, I think every team in the top five league wants Jonathan David. Like, that's not even that hot of a take. I'm sure maybe even like the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, all things removed, that would want Jonathan David. I mean, we went over the stats in terms of where he is in terms of U23 goal scorers, already in a top five league, so he's proven in that regard. You know, what he can bring outside of his goal scoring, which not all strikers always have, that's no doubt, but it's 100% financial. It's, you know, Lille were asking 50 mil before this season. There's just a reality that right now outside the Premier League, that sort of money isn't being thrown around outside what, maybe a half dozen to 10 clubs. I mean, the Premier League these days, yes, everyone could afford a Jonathan David. So that kind of goes out the window. But yeah, you look at the Bundesliga, it's Bayern, it's, I guess, maybe Dortmund, you know, and Mönchengladbach and Leipzig and some of those teams. But even then, you know, they've preferred to go for lower spending options. You look again, Italy is an option because a lot of those clubs have been paying high fees. But as we've seen, there's been a bit of a bubble there. You see what's going on with Juventus. You see some of the reports about just Serie A in general. But I guess if you remove that, maybe a Napoli, maybe, especially if they sell Osimhen, maybe, you know, one of the Milan clubs. again, you go to Spain, it's the big two, but they're pretty set at striker between Lewandowski and Benzema, of course, at Barca and Real Madrid, respectively. You go to PSG, I think they'll be good for a while there with Kylian Mbappe unless he leaves. And I doubt Jonathan David's going to stick in France. So yeah, it just really narrows down the pool when you look at those financial constraints. And then, of course, when you take those financial constraints, there's also a need for strikers. If you're going to spend 50 million on a striker, 50 million plus, you're not going to get it on a striker. That's potentially depth, right? So that just a lot of those constraints does limit the pool of possibilities for Jonathan David, but certainly there will be teams that will come in for him this summer, you have to imagine.
I think it limits the pool as well, but you can also take a look at what Jonathan David has said over the last few months and his desire to play at the top level and play in the Premier League, because he has publicly said that he wants to play in the Premier League, and that's the destination where he sees himself playing. So when you look at what he's done in Ligue 1, and I mean, he's only behind Kylian Mbappe in goals, the world's his oyster in terms of football. It's just a question of who can pay that transfer fee. And if anyone in the Premier League can pay it, which pretty much every Premier League club can, I would imagine that that deal gets done at some point. I'm not surprised it hasn't happened yet, given just he's had a few cold spells and he is a streaky striker, as we know. But I would imagine that that deal gets across the line at some point.
Streaky striker, say that five times fast. Yeah, I mean, it probably will happen in the summer. That seems to be what the club is aiming towards, and David seems to have that understanding. And to his credit, since he's come back from the World Cup, putting that, yes, maybe in terms of the output, disappointing tournament behind him, but I mean, just the rate he's scoring at, the level of activity that he's had, even over the weekend, he didn't score or assist, but probably could have scored, probably could have picked up an assist, just maybe a little bit unlucky. And as I've been saying pretty much the entire season, as long as David stays involved, that's really what matters. Like, if he doesn't score or assist, that's going to happen. Strikers, unless you're maybe Erling Haaland, you're not going to score or assist every game. As long as you stay involved in the play, as long as you are making yourself available, getting shots off, creating chances, that really is what matters. But obviously it will help to get the goals and the assists at the end of the day. And that's what he's been doing. So that's only going to lend credence to him being more Premier League ready than he might have been a few months ago.
Didi Nabsi lasted 72 minutes for Pau before he had to exit with an injury. Ike Ugbo and Twa had the weekend off, but Ugbo has since been linked with return to England, with multiple championship clubs monitoring his situation, according to none other than Fabrizio Romano. And for Matthew, who said, I don't have to pronounce his last name anymore, but I will give it a shot, Ryerchuk. In terms of Ike Ugbo drawing interest from clubs in the championship, which clubs may be a suitable fit for him? He needs to find a club that gives him, hopefully, regular playing time.
Well, a few ideas come to mind, and I don't know if Alex has anything different, but the first two clubs that popped into my head, one was Blackburn, because they're likely losing Ben Brereton, Chile's own, to potentially Villarreal, it looks like. So he's more of a winger, I know, but he's been used as part of a strike duo when Blackburn go 3-5-2 or 4-4-2. Plus, Brereton has scored 9 league goals. He's their top scorer this season. And the next highest scorer for Blackburn is Sam Gallagher with 4. And Ugbo can certainly replace those lost goals if Brereton does end up leaving. The second name that came to mind was Cardiff City, because they could definitely use reinforcements at the 9. Callum Robinson and Mark Harris, their two leading goal scorers, they have a combined 7 goals this season. And kind of similar to Blackburn, they utilize a 3-5-2, sometimes a 4-2-3-1 for the most part, and are clearly in need of goals. So maybe he's a fit there. And I believe before joining Arminia Bielefeld, Corbinu was actually linked to Cardiff earlier in the window. I know that, again, he's a winger, but can play centrally if need be. And either way, they need attacking reinforcements across the board. So that might be a potential option. And then a third one, just to kind of throw it out there, Bristol City, they might lose one of their top scorers in Antoine Semenyo before the window closes. So that's a possible fit. But listen, if they end up signing him on loan and then Semenyo ends up staying, that could turn into a Richie Larea Nottingham Forest situation very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating to see the championship links, because Ike Ugbo, before heading to Troyes, was mulling over options in England. Obviously, you know, being a UK native, that lure of returning home was there. And he went back to Troyes, which was a move that made sense at the time. He was familiar. He had a good run. The thing is with Ugbo, I'm looking at championship clubs. I would like to think he's going to head to at least top half team at the very least, and maybe a team pushing for promotion. Because again, this is someone that last season scored a handful of goals in a top five league for Troyes. So it's not like that disappears over a 12-month period. You know, you even just because he wasn't playing at Troyes. So I'd like to think if he's heading championship, it is in the top half. So I was looking more teams there, a few teams as well that are actually different from Peter's for once. I mean, I started at the top with Burnley, who were interested in him in the summer. So there is a bit of familiarity there. One thing, Burnley, of course, running away with the league, but they haven't really done it with a pure number nine that has ran away with the goal scoring charts. Nathan Tella leads them in goal scoring with 9 goals, but he's a winger who, if I'm not mistaken, is on loan from Southampton. Up front, they've had Jay Rodriguez and a few other options. So there would be some room in that rotation, especially if they're going up. This could be a way for them to get a bit of business done early. I'd like to imagine that Ugbo, given what he's shown in a top five league, could be a Premier League option should he show well in the second half of the season and go up with the team. Another team right away continuing down is Watford. I mean, easy links considering Ismail Kone there. So obviously they know Canadians, but their leading scorer, João Pedro, usually leads the line. He's out injured for a couple more weeks, if I'm not mistaken. And right now, just watching them over this weekend, it felt like they could use the number nine, the replacement they had for Pedro Bio just really didn't, you know, show that much. Of course, it's one game, but statistically this year hasn't shown too much. I think after Pedro's 9 goals, the next best goal scorer is 4 at Watford. So certainly they could potentially use a number nine there. And then, yeah, I mean, other than that, those were the two options I highlight off the top. Of course, easy to go for the top two of the top three teams, but there is a surprise. It's not, I just reference those because say last year when Fulham was running away with the league, Alexander Mitrovic had what, like 30 goals? Like it was an obvious, clear number nine hierarchy there. Whereas you look at these clubs, there's not like a guy even then who scored 15, 20. I mean, you look at Sheffield United, yeah, they've had Illiman and GI, so that's why I didn't point them out. But you look at Burnley and Watford, there's surprisingly not a guy who's running away with, say, a top season in that regard. You look at most of the top goal scorers in the league, they're actually all on middling a club. So those are two of the names I looked at in terms of clubs. And also nice thing about Burnley, they play good football. They hold on to the ball. I do think that would suit someone like Ike Ugbo.
Playing time and regular playing time at this point in Ike Ugbo's career, incredibly important as we move over to Belgium. And in Belgium, Tejan Buchanan returned to right back for Club Bruges in a draw with Zulte Waregem. He had a key pass and a shot in the 90 minutes. And another question from Matthew Ryerchuk. With Dumfries and his agent meeting with clubs in the Premier League for a possible transfer, will Tejan Buchanan move this window, or based on the timeline, is a summer transfer more likely?
It's almost definitely going to be in the summer for two reasons, and we did go over it briefly last week, but just to reiterate, Inter probably won't sell Dumfries until the summer because they got to push for Champions League. Suning is in a lot of financial trouble. Qualifying for the Champions League would maybe help mitigate some of the losses that they're expected to bring in. And it's ditto for Bruges because they could advance to the quarterfinals of the Champions League this year and need their key players to make that push, obviously, and Buchanan is going to be one of them. But, you know, guys, one thing I kind of entered my mind as I was watching the game this weekend, and it's kind of similar to this transfer saga. I don't think it's a coincidence that we saw him at right back again over the weekend, because that's now 3 games where, even if it's just for 10, 15 minutes, he has played right back under Scott Parker so far. He played the last 10, 15 minutes against Anderlecht, I believe it was, when he started at right wing there. And part of me wonders if Bruges are doing this because they're aware of the interlinks and how he's viewed as a Dumfries replacement. And then you see him play against St. Truiden in midweek when he got consecutive starts in his preferred right wing role. And you start to wonder if right back is the play for the rest of the season regardless, because St. Truiden marked him really touch tight and kept him at bay compared to the Anderlecht match. So perhaps it's something that they'll do in certain games to ensure that Buchanan evades that sort of treatment. But then on the flip side, the one time he got free, or really one of 2 times he got free, he produced the pass that led to the own goal. So I still think he's obviously best suited as a right winger due to the threat he poses on the dribble, the fouls that he draws, even if he doesn't maybe beat his man first time. It's worth it for that one moment of quality, as we saw in that game. Now, this was also three games in a row on very little rest, so rotation factored into this as well, I'm sure. But I feel like that point might still stand. It could be something to really worth that could be worth watching over the next few weeks just to see what happens, especially leading in the Champions League as well.
Kind of ironic, too, because Bruges have been struggling offensively just since the break. I mean, that's part of the reason why Carl Hopkins, you know, left. They bring in Scott Parker. He hasn't really changed much in that regard. Like, they have 5 goals, I think, if I'm not mistaken, since the winter break. And the funny thing is, Tejan Buchanan's been directly involved in 3 of them because he won a penalty on their first game back. Then he ended up getting the direct assist, and then he ends up assisting the own goal, which in my eyes, that's an assist. Like,
that's an assist.
It doesn't get counted as one, but it's an assist. So it's one where it's like, yeah, the right back thing makes sense when you mention it like that, Peter. Maybe you're kind of showcasing him. Of course, we know he can play right back. I mean, I'm going to stand with the point that I think at this stage, his best position is probably a wing back from what we've seen. So it's, again, it makes those interlinks make sense. But arguably, you do wonder, playing him up right on right wing could, like, it's just confusing from a Bruges standpoint, because if he's producing, you know, assists, penalty wins, etc., would that not boost his value a bit more? Because, you know, clubs are always going to be looking at goals, assists, goal contributions. And obviously, for a team struggling for goals, you'd also probably like to put the guys who are helping you get goals in positions to score them. But then again, they've just inexplicably kind of benched Ferran Jukla after his excellent first half of the season. So obviously, there's been a bit of a reshuffling in the hierarchy that they need to work out. But to answer the original question, Tejan Buchanan is likely going to leave in the summer. Again, it's Champions League. It's trying to salvage this real shocking run they have so they can try to get any sort of European soccer. I think the title is dead for them at this point. Genk has run away with it, but there's still a shot at maybe Europa League. Maybe you get, you know, Conference League just to get some sort of European soccer. And of course, you do as well as you can in the Champions League. So question is, where does Buchanan play between now and then? Is it going to be to showcase him to Inter as a right back? Is it they're just going to give up and play him up the field and let him run loose? Maybe they switch formations. Who knows? Because right now, Bruges is struggling. I'm sure they're all options are on the table.
Kyle Larin wasn't in the matchday squad for Bruges as he completed a loan move to Real Valladolid in La Liga, the 7th Canamente player in a Tier 1 environment. To Portugal, Stefan Estácio started his first game for Porto since returning from the World Cup. He had 85 minutes in a 1-0 victory. Safe to say we can breathe a sigh of relief that he's starting again. Steven Vitoria was a late substitute in Chavez's 1-1 draw with Boavista on Monday. And to the EFL, Ismael Kone started and played 65 minutes in Watford's 1-1 draw with Rotherham in the championship. From Felipe Vallejo at Felipe V underscore FC, Ismael Kone played as a 10 this past weekend and seemed to struggle. Is this a case of simply being played out of position, or does he need to work on this part of his game and adapt into the new role, which is better for his career?
You know, I actually thought he was fine in that role, and he was also very good last week too. I think Rotherham just really frustrated Watford with how they pressed and harried everybody, so there wasn't a lot of space to really exploit and to hit those line-breaking passes. But to Kone's credit, he was trying. There were a couple of occasions when he took a bit too long to release the ball, and it led to some turnovers. But I think I've said this now for a couple of weeks. That's something he's going to adapt to, right? It's that pace of play. It's realizing that, hey, I don't have that extra second or two on the ball like I had in MLS anymore. I got to be a little more decisive with my decision-making. And he is slowly adapting to it, to his credit. But what I've been really impressed by is his defending. He's constantly tracking down a runner, recovering possession cleanly, and that's been so crucial for Watford in these games because that creates counterattacking opportunities, and that also gives him the chance to really spread his wings and showcase some of his best abilities, which is exploiting space, running into that open space and taking advantage of it. Sure, it didn't maybe lead to goals or assists or maybe as strong of a performance, at least on the eye, and compared to the first couple of games, but I thought he was still pretty decent considering. And to be fair to Kone as well, he came through the Montreal system as a winger. He did play as one of the more advanced midfielders once he broke through into the first team. I think it's a role he's comfortable in. And he's really not your typical 10. Like, he does really play more like an 8, or, as I'm sure Alex is going to be pleased to see, as more of a destroy and progress midfielder really since he's gotten to Watford.
Yeah, I mean, this Watford game was strange just to watch. I mean, Watford uncharacteristically felt like they just couldn't hold on to the ball. They kept hoofing it long. Bio, the striker they had that I mentioned earlier, just was struggling to let anything stick to him. You know, the wingers weren't getting much going. It was, I guess, yeah, it was frustrating to watch from a sense that if you can imagine being Ismail Kone and you're kind of, he was showing into these pockets and he just wasn't getting the ball because it kept going long. And then, yeah, it's one where you're playing the 10. Where do you want to go? You want to go between the lines. You want to find the space. And Rotherham, the way they were playing, they got their goal. They were not going to let much space between the lines. So it's one where you look at those things. I wasn't too displeased, to be honest, seeing Ismail Kone's performance. I thought he did okay. And when he got on the ball, he did well. If anything, again, it just shows what he's best at. And at this stage, he's really... The best way I'd describe him, if someone asks, is he's a ball shuttler. This is someone who gets on the ball and he shuttles it forward. He's someone who likes to do so in intricate ways. He'll get it. He'll play a long ball or he'll play short passes and then move into space, like Peter mentioned, off the ball. And the thing is with the role like that, it really varies on the sort of game. It felt like maybe in this game, he should have been played as an eight just based on where the space is. But there's other games where maybe there's a little more space between the lines. He'd thrive as a 10. Then there's games where you almost want to play him as a six just because it'll get him the most touches on the ball. So it's one where reality, the best position for Ismail Kone based on his attributes, there's no easy way just because, again, wherever the space is, wherever the time he'll get on the ball is the real answer. So Watford's been experimenting with it as they try to find it, and I think that'll be something that they learn. Montreal did a great job of just realizing, okay, we'll play him in this sort of hybrid role where he kind of gets to go wherever he wants because you got Victor Wanyama there, so you can drop as deep as you need. You can go as high as you need on the field. So, again, yeah, he's going to have to adjust to finding that sort of role at the championship where he might not have those sort of freelancing time just because you're going to need to be more tactically disciplined. So, I mean, yeah, it's something that Watford's going to adjust with as well. It's something as well. They're going to have to adjust their play style. It's something where that game just, they looked off, and we'll see if they can get back to their usual ways next weekend.
Junior Hoilett logged 67 minutes as Reading was crushed 4-0 by Stoke on Saturday. Daniel Jebison stayed hot with the goal for Sheffield United against Hull City on Friday. He had 71 minutes in what was his second start in the last three games. Flash in the pan, or can he maintain this? In Scotland, Alistair Johnston went the full 90 midweek for Celtic against St. Mirren in the Scottish Premiership, and then 90 again in a 5-0 win over Greenock Morton in the Scottish Cup on Saturday. David Wotherspoon had about 10 minutes in St. Johnston's 1-0 loss to Rangers in their Scottish Cup matchup. At Ross County, Victor Latoury played the entire second half and extra time as they lost 5-3 on penalties to Hamilton, not Forge FC. Latoury converted his penalty in the shootout. Atiba Hutchinson was an unused substitute for Besiktas in their 2-0 win over Kayserispor over the weekend. He had 20 minutes in extra time in the midweek Turkish Cup loss to Ankara Gucu. Liam Miller went 58 minutes for Basel in their 1-1 draw with St. Gallen in their return to action in Switzerland. Miller actually started this game as an inverted winger on the right off of his usual left wing. What did you think of him there?
I did actually quite like him out there, especially on the counter, because, you know, having those chances to kind of run into space and you're on your favored side just in terms of what foot you have. And, you know, you're running in from the right. You're kind of cutting inside. The angle sometimes does help you. I know it also can behoove you if you're cutting in from the left, going onto the right, because then you can curl it into the far post, but sometimes it can help you on the other side as well. And really had two very good chances in those situations in the first half, but the goalkeeper made two top drawer saves and prevented a goal from happening. But I think what's most notable is that even though the shooting threat was there from Miller, it didn't take away from his playmaking, which has been off the charts good this year. He still had, I think, 3 out of 5 accurate crosses. It was a key pass and 0.25 expected assists in that game, which is just slightly above what he's averaging throughout the entire season domestically. And I've always wondered, too, if moving him to a right wing role with Canada would behoove him. He's actually spent a little bit of time out there in his recent appearances. I mean, it's a moot point now if Herdman goes back to a 3-5-2, but if he uses a 3-4-3, a 4-3-3, etc., then it can open the door for that possibility again, at least if Miller ends up sticking there at club level.
Yeah, and I mean, Liam Miller gets 0.68 XG off two shots in this game as well. That's his most XG in a game since October. So obviously, getting in the dangerous areas, you do feel like his slump's going to end. And yeah, I mean, the thing is with Liam Miller, he is obviously someone who's very comfortable with his right foot. So it really depends what you kind of want from him. I feel like for Canada, it depends. If you have him at right wing, it's okay. You want him, I guess, more running, crossing, getting cutbacks, which if Jonathan David or Kyle Larin are starting, I suppose that suits both of their play styles. But also maybe if you're playing Alphonso Davies a little deeper as a left back, or Sam Etikugbe, of course, and you want him to cut inside and free up space for them to overlap, he can do that. So nice thing is about Liam Miller, he is, you know, he's had that versatility since his Liverpool U23 days. He's always been comfortable playing anywhere on the front three. And the good thing for Canada is that it gives you different looks. Okay, you want a guy who can run under the byline and cut back, you play him on the right. You want him to cut inside, you play him on the left, based on your tactical needs. So it's been a weird one for this year. Basel, especially after he scored so many goals last year, he's been so snake-bitten this year. But continue to get in the right areas, continue to get chances. Basel as a whole, just again, they've been struggling. They're fifth in the Super League, which again is very unusual for Basel, especially in a 10-team league, one they typically dominate. So it's one that hopefully he can get his legs going and get some goals soon, and Basel can find their form again.
Switching over to the women, Ashley Lawrence started for PSG in a wild 4-4 draw with Fleury. Marie Levasseur had an assist for Fleury. On Saturday, Jenna Hellstrom scored her first goal for Dijon in a 1-0 win over Guingamp. Vanessa Gilles went the full 90 to help Lyon keep a clean sheet in a 2-0 victory versus Montpellier. Julia Grosso remains in fine form after registering an assist for Juventus in a 2-1 win over Pomigliano. She now leads Serie A with assists with 6. Adriana Lyon was an unused substitute again for Manchester United in their 1-0 win against Reading. No Jade Riviere yet, as she just signed with the club, but certainly big news as she makes her way over to the Women's Super League. And from Chris Doxfooty, at Chris Doxfooty, will Jade Riviere play left back for Manchester United? And Mark Carveo with a very similar question as well, at IggyFan2001. So is Manchester United actually going to use Jade Riviere, or do we have another Adriana Leon situation on our hands?
Well, I'll answer Chris's question first, but I mean, she could start out there, but it sounds like, based on what you read from the coaching staff and just with the various reports out there, that Riviere is going to probably be used on the right fairly soon, because it sounds like they really want to utilize her attacking qualities from the right wing. And United is in a title chase right now, so all the more reason to put some attacking firepower in there, especially with her ability to get up and down the field. But what's especially beneficial in terms of her probably not becoming an Adriana Leon situation is, you know, she's entering a title chasing environment, yes, but she's used to the pressure, having played, 36 times for Canada. I think it's at all levels combined already. So like that's pretty much the best way to prepare for those situations. And it might take her some time to adapt tactically, but I can't see her not playing right away as soon as she's ready in terms of her tactical preparation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting going to see her battle for position, because her main competition right now, right back's Ona Battle, who is actually, she's been in fine form offensively. She has 6 assists this year, which is top 3 in the FAWSL, and one of the top in the top 5 leagues in Europe right now. Obviously looking for a bit of creativity on the right. So I guess, yeah, maybe we see her spell Battle a bit in terms of, you know, playing time, competition. Also, you do wonder if maybe one of those two move up the field, because like you mentioned, Riviere, a lot of attacking quality, Battle as well. You look at someone, you know, for United, for the way they attack, their wingers haven't exactly been prolific. You look at Nikita Paris, just 2 goals this year, you know, on the left. You look at Lucia Garcia, just 2 goals as well on the right. You look at some of the other options. I mean, of course, you talk to Adriana Leon, maybe Adriana Leon and her goal scoring attributes could be leaned in that way. Of course, Paris, you know, and Garcia, they bring a lot more than just goals, which is obviously why they continue to start and why United's been winning games. But maybe we see, yeah, Riviera Battle move up the wing to bring that creativity in that regard. So, I mean, the nice thing is Riviera, she is young. She's breaking into a pro environment. She's probably not going to debut till February. She recovers from her injury. I think this is one where you're just easing her in, and then we'll see where she's at by the summer. If she can play now, great. But if not, this is one where maybe she heads in the next year, first pro season, and then hits the ground running there. So it's one where, yeah, I mean, will she play left back? Will she play right back? Will she play on the wing? Who knows? But I think it'll be good just to be in this environment and see where she goes from there.
And Kadisha Buchanan and Jessie Fleming had their game against Liverpool abandoned due to a frozen pitch, and that created quite a bit of uproar online and through women's soccer circles and soccer circles as well, as pretty much every player in the world spoke up that it was just absolutely unacceptable to have men's pitches that are able to play in such conditions, but not for the women's in the WSL. Don't forget to follow Canucks Abroad on Twitter at Canucks_abroad and at Instagram at Canucks Abroad for frequent updates on Canadian players worldwide. And I know Brandon Q, a little shout out to him, has been working hard on the Instagram as well to keep up to date with those graphics and to keep you up to date with the Canucks moving abroad and all around the world. And join the Canucks Soccer Chat on Discord and converse with like-minded soccer fans at soccerchat.ca. From wsoccer.ca at wsoccer.ca, could you guys touch on what went down or what didn't go down in the NWSL draft and where you would like to see some of our top prospects land? Examples like Chang, Reagan, DeFilippo, etc.
Yeah, I mean, first off, it's one where this is an unfortunate reality of the NWSL and, again, limitations of what it offers to Canadians is in terms of just Canadian talent, the international spots, et cetera, that teams aren't willing to take a punt on these players unless they're like, yeah, Deanne Rose, I think, was pretty much the last high-profile Canadian draft pick. And that's someone where, okay, Deanne Rose was what, like a 50-capped Canadian international, someone who was already starting for Canada in college. And then, okay, they're going to take a punt on a player like that. But it's one where, you know, unfortunately for a lot of these players, they're not coming out of university with a wealth of Canadian caps, or, you know, it's one where, okay, they just rather take Americans to fill roster spots. And it's fair from their point. It's a market and efficiency thing where if you're bringing in an international, you'd likely want them to be a starter, whereas, you know, a lot of these players are going to likely come in and be depth roles off the start. So again, that just shows a need for, you know, a Canadian league and why would these players need these opportunities so they can at least get that place to get opportunities. I mean, so for most of them, I'm hoping, you know, Europe, especially for someone like Samantha Chang in particular, someone again who, as we've seen, is a very solid midfielder. She has had that, you know, the has played for Canada before. Someone who can, you know, be an option in midfield, maybe somewhere in Europe, maybe some of the Scandinavian leagues, a lot of the Sweden, D1 Arkema. Again, we've seen a lot of Canadians kind of start with mid-table clubs there. So yeah, that's kind of one where it's understandable why things went down in the NWSL draft. We were hoping for something different, but I think a lot of these players, I think I'd like to see them go to Sweden as well as Portugal, Scotland, a lot of these leagues, like we've seen with Clarissa Lyracy, for example. She took a punt and went to Celtic, ended up paying off for her, scored a bunch of goals, and she made a move to the Swedish top flight, one that will help her aspirations a lot for the future. So that's kind of, that's how I'd say it for those. And of course, a lot of other names, Jessica DeFilippo as well, you know, intriguing prospect, a few other Canadian names where you look like, okay, they declared for the draft. They certainly should have options in Europe awaiting them.
And I think there's definitely options for anybody who, in the NCAA. I mean, you play at that level, you can move on to a professional level at somewhere in the world. And I know that I watched a lot of Emma Reagan in the summer. I'm not so familiar with the NCAA athletes, but Emma Reagan, of course, making her way up into League 1 BC and with Varsity FC. Of course, we'll get to Varsity FC and their rebrand and new ownership as well with Hope and Health. We'll get to that later in the show. But Emma Reagan, I mean, the quality she has in the midfield, being able to progress the ball and also just being a stern tackler in the midfield, I think she has the qualities to play professional somewhere. And I mean, that just emphasizes why we need a Canadian league in Canada, and that through Project 8 Sports is going to come in 2025. But we move on to Jacob Box at Jacob Y. D. Enberg. Should Crapo move into the number one spot in terms of minutes for the CanMNT with Bornan's struggles at the World Cup? Is Crapo firmly ahead of Sinclair in the depth chart? And to me, I just think it goes down to where Crapo is in his return and what form he gets when he gets back with his club. I think when he went down, sure, he was the second choice keeper. I think he was better than Sinclair, but where is he at now?
Yeah, exactly. Especially because St. Clair is going to have a head start come this season, right? Because Crapo will still be recovering, although it looks like he's well ahead of schedule. I mean, just the fact that he was already, you know, doing certain exercises and walking right after breaking his tibia and fibula. Like, that's just absolutely insane to me. So clearly he is very motivated to get back out there and pick up where he left off, and credit to Crippo for that. The man's a warrior. So it really will depend, but I don't think even if he was fully 100% fit, let's say he didn't break his leg, that he would be the automatic number one now. Because obviously Milan Borjan at the World Cup, he wasn't himself. He clearly had those two horrific mistakes against Morocco. And even just during the games, he wasn't making those, like, maybe apart from one or two moments in the Croatia game, those game-saving stops that he just became pretty much well-known for in the World Cup qualifying campaign, and in a lot of ways was one of Canada's key players in that regard. He did look a little slower, a little less agile than he normally is, and that's certainly cause for concern, but I don't think it means he should lose his spot now, because in a three-game sample size, and keep in mind, like, this, you know, really random variables can come into play here. He had a post-shot expected goals plus minus of minus 1.6. So he stopped 1.6 goals below expected at the World Cup in three matches. So you look at that and it's not great. I believe that put him in the bottom six among all goalkeepers at the World Cup who started at least a game or two. So it doesn't look good, but I certainly do believe that he'll, at least for March and probably entering the summer, will still be the number one for that reason. But we'll see how St. Clair develops and also how Crippo responds after his injury.
Yeah, I mean, the goalkeeping situation, I feel the way I'd say it is, it's wide open. I mean, but at the same time, there is a clear hierarchy for now. I mean, I still think if you have a game tomorrow, it's Borjan. If Crepo is healthy as Crepo, it's Sinclair. But what I'll say is I think things are really close. And, you know, I guess the wild card there is really Crepo's recovery and then St. Clair himself. Because, you know, one thing with Borjan, again, it's a question of, okay, the sample size, but are those struggles at the World Cup maybe a sign of things to come? There already have been doubts this year with Milan Borjan's play, you know, in Europa League, then there's the quality of, because again, given the quality of competition Milan Borjan faces on a regular basis, you want him shining in the likes of Europa League, Champions League, Conference League, because again, he's not always getting that competition on a week in, week out basis. These games where he's not getting many touches or shots. So because of that, Crepo was already close. We knew that. But of course, Borjan was the guy for this cycle. So we'll see how Borjan comes back from the break. If that was if this season has been a sign of things to come, or if he's used this break and he's going to come back guns a-blazing, ready to keep his spot, etc. And then, of course, we'll see how Crepo recovers. And then Dane Sinclair is the wild card, because we do have to remember he turns 26 this year. He's going to have a second consecutive season of being the guy that Minnesota's cleared the way for him. Tyler Miller is gone. This is Dane Sinclair's net now. I mean, you know, the fact that he's still back, he's in his prime. He's, you know, I guess this will technically be his third kind of full season of workload. If he goes and kills it again, there's at a certain point where, you know, you can only hold him back so much, especially if maybe Borjan dips and Crepo isn't ready. So I think it's one where, yeah, maybe the hierarchy's written out now, but give it 3 or 4 months, I think things could change so much. Because if St. Clair is doing well again, level he was last year, and Borjan slips, why not give St. Clair the net? Especially you're looking ahead to 2026. If the marginal difference is already lower, St. Clair already fits your style of play, why not start planning for 2026, especially if a move like that doesn't cost you? It isn't like a huge downgrade, especially if anything, it's really not a downgrade at all. So I think things are really close right now.
We'll move on to TFCNU at TFCNU2. Are there any rumors about Lucas Cavallini's future?
Nothing new, really. Just that Cavallini is still trying to find a club. His wage demands are reportedly very high, which is why Peñarol and apparently Cruz Azul went with other targets. He still has some interest in Mexico, but it's clearly dissipating fast, especially with those salary demands of his.
I mean, at the end of the day, he's only going to get paid what the market is going to pay for him. And if his demands are too high, well, he's not going to find a club. And eventually he's going to have to adjust if he wants to play professional football in any league of note. He hasn't had the numbers to necessarily demand such high wages over his time with the Vancouver Whitecaps. So, I mean, he's going to have to adjust at some point or something's going to have to give. And I would assume that's going to be Cavallini's wage demands and not a club actually meeting them. From Cameron at CD underscore prior, any news on Damiano Basile? I noticed that he hasn't been getting minutes with Venezia and wondering if we might expect to see him in the CPL anytime soon.
Yeah, it seems like a few North American players have had a hard time at Venezia over the past 12 months, Basile included. I think the next logical step should be the CPL because he's clearly good enough to play in a pro environment, and he's still only 20 years old, right? And this is the time in a player's career where they have to start getting regular minutes in that setting. Now, when he was playing regularly for Venezia's under-19s, he was switching between a number 8 and number 6 role. He showed very good composure, vision, defensive acumen in either position. His only knock was there were times when he didn't read situations quickly enough, maybe took an extra second on the ball that he shouldn't have taken, and it either led to him turning over the ball or he missed a defensive assignment, allowed a late runner into the box, things like that. Those little things that you tend to kind of clean up. But I do think moving to a pro environment can really help him with that last part.
Yeah, and it's just, it's one where Italy, it's a strange environment because, like, there it's just the U19 level. There's not, like, a reserve league or anything. So unless he heads out on loan, it's going to be interesting to see what they do. Because the thing is, again, you look, he did ink a contract through till 2025. And this was not a new problem, say, because he was 20 by the time he signed it. So it's not like, oh, they knew, oh, he aged out of the U19s and we weren't expecting of that. So I'm just curious to see what Venezia thinks, because obviously there's some sort of plan there. You do wonder if it involves a loan. You do wonder if maybe he'll pop out of nowhere into the first team soon. It's worth noting this has been a known issue with other players. I mean, there's also former Philadelphia Union player Jack DeVries, who joined Venezia around the same time as Basile. They popped off in the U19s, and he's also been a player that just hasn't been seen on any sort of team sheets or around lately as well. So it's going to be interesting to see, because again, you don't sign a player, you'd like to think you don't sign a player till 2025 not having a plan. And hey, I guess for Canadian's sake, it would be nice to see maybe a loan to the CPL, maybe a loan elsewhere in Italy. At the very least, he has a European passport, as we know, so maybe he moves to a different club in Europe, because there's obviously potential there, and maybe goes to a team where they have a U23 set up and you can really, just get back to playing or, regularly in that sort of setup. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where he goes next because of all that.
You know, what's interesting, too, is Venezia is in the relegation zone in Serie B. They're 3 points away from safety, but they're struggling this season. So if they get relegated again, they may not have any choice but to start offloading some of those younger players, and especially the North American players who they probably did sign because of those North American connections in the first place.
Well, at least they look good in terms of their relegation, not so much on the pitch, but their kits are certainly some of the best in world football. And we'll move on to MLS and CPL, and certainly a lot of news as well, as we're nearly just under a month away from MLS kicking off. I can't quite wrap my head around that. MLS kickoffs just creeping earlier and earlier in the year, seemingly every year. But Can Champ news, we'll start off with that. Draws on January 31st, but we know the following. Cavalry, HFX, Valor, and Vancouver FC will open on the road due to stadium availability and weather conditions. That means TSS Rovers at Swangard Stadium and Pacific FC at Starlight Stadium are guaranteed to host, as well as an Eastern team that crosses over. And an Eastern crossover sounds like the CFL to me. Laval and Vaughan cannot be drawn against each other, so they'll play one of the East Pro teams. First round kicks off April 18 to 20. Quarters are May 9 to 11. Semis are May 23rd to 25, and the final will be played in early June. The Vancouver Whitecaps and Toronto FC receive first round byes as the 2022 champion and runner-up. The Caps will likely slot in on the west side and TFC on the east side. As was the case in 2022, all potential hosts from round one to the final will be drawn ahead of time. And Canadian MLS clubs were drawn into their League's Cups groups. Vancouver are with Lyon and the LA Galaxy, Toronto with Atlas and NYCFC, Montreal with Pumas and DC United. And certainly going to be interesting with Montreal against DC United, with Hernan Losada now on CF Montreal's side. But if we take a look at the Canadian Championship, and it's fantastic to see how big it's grown, a little bit of a confusing structure, but I think one that will create some magical moments, especially with the first round at Swangard.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't know why they don't just draw the tournament and then let you know, all those details kind of come out after the fact. I guess one way or another, they were going to release it anyways. But I mean, this is great. And especially because of the fact that you're going to have the likes of TSS Rovers hosting, you're going to have some intriguing matchups involving those, you know, League One Ontario, League One BC, PLSQ teams. You got some newcomers coming like Vancouver. It's going to be fascinating. And we've all been dreaming of an expanded Canadian championship for years. And the fact that you now have all these clubs from all different sides of the Canadian pyramid is great. It's obviously going to take maybe a bit of time for maybe certain, I guess, cup upsets to happen, like maybe a team making a deeper run. But I mean, CPL clubs have done pretty well in the Canadian championship since they entered. So maybe these other clubs will start doing the same very soon.
Yeah, it's a good progress. I mean, it's a bit unfortunate about the stadium availability thing, but it's fair. I mean, for example, yeah, places like Calgary and, you know, it's not exactly warm even in April in Calgary. So obviously understandable from that standpoint. Because one thing is, I really do want, like, for example, to see the semi-pro teams host an MLS team. Because come on, like, tell me it wouldn't be great to see Vaughn hosting TFC with Insigne going up against the Azzurri. I mean, come on. Or you look at, like, Ryan Gauld running up against the Rovers at Swangard, or, you know, Montreal trying to go up against Laval. So, I mean, my dream matchup, I guess, right off there is please give me Laval hosting Montreal, because I think that's the only one possible. Because if Montreal crosses over to the West, versus Laval or Vaughan, because if Montreal goes to the West, they cannot draw the Rovers, because Rovers will be hosting, as with Montreal, because whoever's from the East crosses over. But yeah, just give me some fun matchups. There's so much potential. I do like that they're going regional, just because obviously you'd like an open draw, but obviously that'll help alleviate travel. That'll help alleviate some of that sort of logistical stuff. So just give me good matchups. Screw it. Give me Pacific versus Vancouver FC. Give me Rovers versus like a Cavalry or, a Valor. And then, you know, maybe the Rovers pull off an upset, and then you get Rovers versus one of the other Vancouver based teams, maybe the Whitecaps. Just give me all the cup sets. Give me all the entertaining matchups. Give me like a Montreal versus Laval. Give me a TFC versus Vaughan or York or one of the local teams. So yeah, it's good to see these sort of matchups, and I'm curious to see how things are drawn out. And hey, last year's edition was the best of the tournament. Let's see if they can maintain that standard once again this year.
And as well, we'll jump to a question from Nicholas Friend at friend_Nicholas. And it's a question about Varsity FC, as we're touching on League One BC and League One participation in the national championship. We take a look at Varsity FC, and they've been sold to Hope and Health, an Indigenous organization that helps youth, Indigenous youth in BC get into soccer. And they're looking for young Indigenous players to join the semi-pro ranks as well in League One BC. And so I think that's a fantastic area of growth to see UBC Athletics sell the club or transfer ownership to the club to Hope and Health. And they're going to go through a rebrand. It's not going to be Varsity FC anymore, but it's certainly going to be interesting to see that Indigenous outreach in the Canadian soccer pyramid that hasn't necessarily been there before.
Well, yeah, no, I think this is a fascinating venture. Obviously, Hope and Health very involved in the soccer community in BC. The Whitecaps obviously do a lot of camps and clinics with them. Ditto with Pacific FC as well as UBC. So it's obviously been a staple of the community. They're really trying to improve and push Indigenous participation in the sport. It has also resulted in a few initiatives, such as on the island. They constructed the five-a-side fields to really help kids play throughout the year, especially with rain, especially, you know, quality pitches not always being there. So it's great to see that sort of access provided. And, you know, again, yeah, we're seeing a little bit of a boon in that regard. Like, for example, FIFA 23 in their Volta game mode, they included a Musqueam pitch, they included some Musqueam merch. So obviously, again, it's great to see just that sort of representation and that push, and now having a stake in ownership in a team that was so successful last year at the semi-pro level. It'll be great. Hopefully we can see some players get some opportunities. What I like to see is that they mentioned they're also looking to really give coaches in that side of the game's opportunity. So we really see some Indigenous representation on the coaching and management side, which I think is long overdue. Just in general, Canadian soccer has really lacked, you know, Indigenous representation as a whole. So it's great to see all those initiatives. I'm going to be curious to see how it all wraps out. But it's also just great for League 1BC because, again, for the success Varsity had on the field, they were definitely one of the best teams to watch in League 1BC. There was also just a feel that they weren't really a community club. And, you know, it's one where they were kind of a lot of UBC players trying to stay fit, trying to just win some games and focus on that season. It is nice to see a bit of that community ownership come in. And because you saw what it meant to the Rovers with their fans, now you're going to likely see Varsity FC, their new version, attract fans from in that regard. You see Harbourside come in. That looks like an intriguing ownership venture. We know about the Highlanders. We've seen, you know, I'm sure Rivers will be building something, especially after TRU won the men's, you know, Nationals. And of course, you know, we'll see all this on the women's side as well. It's good to see the League 1BC grow, and I'd really love to see how things are going to grow on the fan side. We saw what Altitude fans did for their men and women, the Rovers, etc. And with these sorts of developments, things are only going to grow from there.
And for those who don't necessarily know what Hope and Health is, it's a program that's been run by the Vancouver Whitecaps, by the UBC soccer program as well, and Pacific FC playing a role in that as well as a lot of local clubs and organizations coming together to help youth in Indigenous youth get into sport and just get that experience of playing a team sport. And in terms of coaches, well, UBC players have been helping to teach these players for years now. And now some of them are getting into coaching, getting into playing at higher levels. But that's all to say, there will still be an involvement with UBC Athletics and the UBC men's and women's soccer team. So still expect to see a lot of Thunderbirds players playing for what I'll call for now Hope and Health FC. But we'll move on to MLS updates. Whitecaps played two friendlies and they lost 2-0 to Hamburg and 2-1 to Wolfsburger. Ty Baribo scored for Wolfsburger. Ex-Whitecaps defender Marcus Godinho has joined Dominik Zator in Poland at Krona Kielce. CF Montreal is nearing a deal to trade Joaquin Torres to the Philadelphia Union. Meanwhile, TFC is still trying to complete a deal for the in-demand Sean Johnson, who was seen at a Raptors game sitting courtside, while Nobel Akello is trialing with Inter Miami. TFC also acquired 25-year-old left back Raul Patreta from Turkish side Kasimpasa as he came through the Basel system and has UCL and UEL appearances under his belt. And from Michael Rice, at Mike Rice, 1983, hoping to see Sean Rea get a chance at Montreal, but what other players in this TPL last season could get a chance to impress in MLS this season?
Great question. Honestly, I could see possibly Isaiah Johnston at some point getting a run with Nashville. You know, he just signed for Huntsville a few weeks ago. He's highly regarded in the Canadian soccer community. Based on what I hear out of Nashville, they rate him very highly. I wouldn't be shocked if he maybe makes a push. Otherwise, I mean, I'm going to bring up my boy Karifa Yao. I feel like I have to. And just given that there's still uncertainty with, you know, Vancouver's center back situation, I feel like he could still have a bit of a shot. Might not be a, you know, every week starter, but he'll certainly have opportunities to impress as the preseason continues here.
Yeah, I mean, Karifa Yao, I think, is the big one, him and Sean Rea, just because they're heading the clubs that have roles for them. Sean Rea, of course, looking to fill Georgi Mihailovic's shoes, especially if Joaquin Torres goes. That's great for Sean Rea. Again, more options are chances for him to potentially slot in high up the field. Ditto Karifa Yao with the Whitecaps not signing a Daniel Crutzen. You know, after Ranko Veselinovic, you know, Matias Laborda and Tristan Blackman. I mean, Karifa Yao is pushing him and Matteo Campagna, another Canadian as well, of course, as we know, pushing from there. Former CPLer, but obviously from a while back, are pushing for minutes in the CB. If not, I mean, yeah, other than that, a lot of these guys, it's going to be interesting to see who can make that jump from MLS Next Pro. For example, Nessie Mekidesh signed this week with SKC's second team. SKC struggled last year. I mean, I don't think they'll be that bad. Just, you know, they made some great signings and finished strong, and they've got Alan Polito returning. But hey, maybe if they have some more defensive struggles and Nessie Mekidesh shines in the SK2, maybe he could be a dark horse to maybe push up to the first team level. But yeah, I mean, other than that, we'll be remain to see if there's any last minute transfers on that regard. But well, I guess we'll see.
And from Borjan's Pants at Borjan's Pants, any update on Lowell Wright? He looked like a decent product with York and the under-20 team, but since he moved to the Vancouver Whitecaps FC2, we haven't heard much. and it looks like he hasn't played much there. So what's up with Lowell Wright?
Yeah, well, for Lowell Wright, I mean, he just joined, you know, at a strange time. I think there was about 5 games left in the Whitecaps MLS Next Pro season because it ended in September. They had Easton Ongaro, who was firing. They had Simon Betcher, who was firing. And then he couldn't start right away. Like, he didn't train right away. He's recovering from some sort of knock, or had some paperwork that was being assorted. So he just really started late. Like, he only got a chance to play in 3 games, if I'm not off the top of my head, for the Caps. And then the season was over, so it was just really training, because the first team was in a playoff push, and, you know, minutes are always going to be hard to come by there. So I think this is going to be a big year for him now, because Simon Betcher has moved up to the first team, especially if the White Caps don't really have striker depth for now. Simon Betcher will likely stick up there. You know, obviously Easton Ongaro is gone, Levante Johnson is in, but that's someone where, again, Lowell Wright is younger and has pro minutes. I think it's one where, and he's familiar with the system, maybe Wright kind of gets an edge over him for now. Maybe Wright and Johnson end up playing together. So I think it's one where he's going to get a good run with the Whitecaps MLS Next Pro team. And then it'll remain to see if he can bag a few goals, get running, and then we'll start to see some call-ups to the first team. So no, I'm not worried at all about Lowell Wright. He's still just 19, which is important to remember. He's still super young. It's someone where, given what he's already had with his resume at the pro level at his age, for him to get this shot at, he's in a very good position, and hopefully he can bag a few goals, start the year for Whitecaps FC too.
And from North Fan Steve, at North Fan Steve, any thoughts on Kyle Hibbert as a future dark horse center back candidate for the CanMNT?
I think we've been saying this for a while now, but he actually does have a real shot at being that. There are some injuries with St. Louis's defense. He's probably going to get a chance to start the season, and then from there, who knows? And look, he's not going to be a center back who like blows the doors off of you in terms of, you know, his technical ability, his defensive ability, but he's just a solid all-around center back. And the Canadian player pool can use guys like that, especially playing at that kind of a level every week. So yeah, he has every chance of being a dark horse candidate for sure.
And from Matt12Mark, at Matt12Mark1, what role will Charles Auguste have with the Houston Dynamo this season?
Well, Houston's midfield is fairly thin, so he might actually surprise a few people. Like, I actually chatted with a few of those who knew him from Quebec, and I mean, he's the pure definition of a box-to-box midfielder. So I'm sure that'll help him gain some minutes in that first team environment, or at the very least get a look early in the season. But I could see him starting out with a second team first, maybe making a push into the first team. But from what I hear, though, a lot of people are like, keep an eye on this kid, because first of all, he's 22, 23, I believe. So he's a bit of a late bloomer, but he flew under the radar. And as soon as Houston signed him, everyone's like, listen, they might have a gem on their hands here. So keep an eye out for him.
Yeah, and again, you look at what he was able to do at the NCAA level with the Creighton Blue Jays. He has very high passing numbers. Like, he was completing over 88% of his passes, but he was still, you know, hovering around the 0.08 XG and around 0.08 XA, getting a decent amount of key passes, a lot of forward passes, wins a lot of duels. Like, those are a lot of key attributes to look like. So yeah, from what I've seen as well, looks like an intriguing player. I'd imagine he starts maybe with the second team, but if he can get a good run of minutes there, Houston will, you know, always looking for a bit of help in the midfield. Their midfield was a bit, I mean, they brought in Karaskia last year and he was good, you know, but they did lose Memo Rodriguez this year, and, you know, they'll be looking for some placements. Plus there's the Canadian connection at Houston, of course, with Pat Onstead. So curious to see how Auguste gets on, because if he can, you know, get some good minutes at the second team level and push up, seems to be an intriguing midfield prospect.
Plenty of CPL news as well. Daniel Kreutzen is leaving Forge after 4 seasons, and he's heading to Phoenix Rising in the USL. Nassim Mekideshe joined Sporting KC2 from Valor after a 2-week trial. And Valor goalkeeper Ryan Yesley is trialing with Hasio in France. And a question from Matthew Ryerchuk. Why are so many Canadians getting the chance for these short training and trial stints abroad? Is it based on the CPL status as an improved league, or is it clubs taking a big chance on Canada as an untapped market?
I think it's a variety of factors, really. One of them is some of these players do have the passport, and therefore a move is easier if they are chosen to stick around. But some of it is the fact that Canada is now an untapped market. Some of it is the fact that you know, the CPL is slowly starting to gain a bit of a reputation, at least in this part of the world, in CONCACAF, as they continue to do well in continental competitions, as Canadian players continue to get more first team opportunities. And as we see more guys going into the youth team environments, that only helps it, right? And I will say this, I'm very surprised at how many of these players are getting trials. But it also has a lot to do with some of the connections these clubs have. Like, you know, Atletico Ottawa, the connections they have with their parent club in Mexico, just throughout the footballing world, that's obviously going to help their players. Same with a lot of these, you know, ex-pros who have shares in the CPL clubs as well, because they'll inevitably have connections to other clubs and contacts, right? So all of this is to say that it is very good. I do know for a fact that Canada, especially now, is very much seen as an untapped market. That is very much true. And for that reason, a lot of these clubs, especially with kind of the financial situation they're in, they see a lot of value there. So if they can get their foot in the door early with these players, the better it is for them.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, first of all, there's a lot of fascinating relationships being built, you know, in the CPL. And, you know, you add also League One into that. You look at some of these players that have been coming to the league through, you know, the 21st club partnership, et cetera. You look as well where some of these players are going. Those sort of partnerships are crucial. And yeah, I mean, there's just a matter of the fact that the CPL has done a good job in terms of, you know, promoting its its young developing players, if you think about it, because every game in the league's broadcast in one place. So it's easy to access footage. All the league is the league is very easily accessible statistically. I mean, all data is made free to access. It's all the league is on, you know, Y Scout, et cetera, et cetera. It's easy to find clips. That might be a small thing to look at, but it's funny you mentioned it. I was on Twitter today and someone was mentioning how there's this player in, I think it was the Burundi league, who, because that year they finally invested in Y Scout data to track the league, and one of the players immediately became noticed, got signed by a Turkish club for a mil, and like 2 years later he's signing for Nice for 20 million. And that's just because the Burundi league, they track, they had data, they had video, and teams were able to scout it from afar, because there's a reality that it's hard to scout some of these leagues, like, you know, Canada, for example. It's far to come to Canada. For if you're a team in, you know, a Ligue 2 team in France, it's not easy, like PAL when they're signing Abdi, it's not easy to come over to York, or even if York's, you want to scout him and York's playing Pacific, Vancouver FC, Cavalry all away in a string of games, like you're gonna have to fly across the world, where, you know, if you're a France team, you can go scout the Netherlands very easily, you can go scout nearby. So having this video, having this data really helps teams just have an input of pool on these players, and you know that they're going to be coming at a cheaper price. It's a market efficiency. So those little things are paying off, and you add in the connections, it's really, you know, helped things in that regard. And it shows the benefit of being a league that really pushes data forward, because I think a lot of players are benefiting it from some of these moves.
And from Michael Rice at Mike Rice 1983, which CPL young Canadians have a big season ahead of them, whether it's moved to MLS or abroad? And from Oz Sweeney at Oz Sweeney 4, who are your CPL players to watch that you will hope make the jump to MLS or abroad next season? Sort of similar questions, and we'll address them both right now. And there's certainly some players that we could see moving up into a higher level, just given what the CPL has done in the past.
Exactly. And I'll start with one of the obvious ones, but Osase de Rosario. The fact he's staying at York for another season is huge, because he kind of entered, you know, as the season was starting or in the earlier stages of the season, but hit the ground running and had a very solid 2022. Can't imagine what 2023 is going to be like for him, especially if, you know, 2022, that form can be picked up this year. But I'll also throw in my boy and Alex's boy, Sean Young. There's a lot of potential there. He could actually make some pretty decent waves this season. But there are a number of candidates in that regard. I can let Alex answer some. I don't want to say he's going to jump abroad, but someone who I feel could be Balu Tabla. Like, he's still 23 years old. Had a really good year with Atletico Ottawa. Yeah, I mean, because he came through when he was 18. Remember that whole debate, is he going to go play for the Ivory Coast? Is Didier Drogba going to convince him to play there? Is he going to play for Canada? Everyone breathed a sigh of relief when he played for Canada and got capped. And then everything just went south. So the fact he's still 23, is coming off a great season with Ottawa, even better than I expected, to be honest. you imagine what can happen, especially because I feel like if he does end up having another good season in his age 24 campaign, he can still go to MLS and make an impact, maybe go abroad to a lower level league and do something there, but the potential is still definitely there.
Yeah, a lot of options. I'm going to try to ring through a few in no particular order as I kind of scroll through. I'll throw someone from Ottawa, Zachariah Bahous. He was someone who impressed me a lot as the year went along as he grew into a role. Obviously, he was played a lot for U21 minutes, but he stood out. And I think, you know, Ottawa will look to give him a bigger role again this year. Another one is for me is Ali Moussi. I thought he was excellent last year. He can really be electric in the final third, a dual threat in terms of his shooting and passing, which is always nice. He's someone who maybe another strong season. He's a little older on the 26-27 side, but again, that's still very young in that sense, especially as a good season there. You look elsewhere. I think Christian Campagna, how young he is and how excellent he looks stepping right in to the Halifax Wanderers. Center back, you see what he did at the MLS Next Pro level. You see him trial over in Germany. That's someone where you look like, okay, maybe if he has a huge year, you add in a couple of his teammates as well. Mo Omar, Zachary Fernandez. Those are a couple of youngsters all on the defensive side that could really, you know, pop off. Throw in also Wes Timoteo and Sam Salter into that mix. Again, you add Sean Young from Pacific. I think Kunle Dadaluk as well has to be someone after, if he has another strong year, especially at his position and what he can bring. You'd have to imagine teams will be looking at someone who can play as a fullback, can play as a wingback as well. As for Pacific, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye on their center backs because Thomas Mertziger stays again. Amir Didic stays again. Again, they're not on the young side. They're past 25, but for center back, that's young. And if they have another good season at a certain point, you do wonder on that regard. You know, elsewhere, if Rubens Pasillas ends up back at Forge, that's a pretty easy name to look at as well. Kwasi Poku as well. Like, the fact that he got a trial with the Swedish champions, Häcken, started for their first friendly of the year at center back. That's someone who's a midfielder who's played left back, can play out wide, can play in center back now. Like, that's someone who's incredibly versatile. He's got the physical tools. He's a great passer. That feels like someone, if Kwasi Poku can really pop off this year, that's another name. And just continue. I mean, there's a whole host of players at York. Of course, you have Ozaze Di Rosario, Max Ferrari coming back from injury. That's someone who impressed in his pre-injury seasons. If he can pop off, especially with Mo Babuli back for another year, you look at some of the additions they've made. Of course, if Ronan Kratt ends up returning as well, that's going to be a fun attack to watch. Can be interesting to see how the defense shapes up, especially you got Clement Baia, who's going to be sort of the Diadine Abzi replacement. Obviously not like for like, but in terms of attacking input from the fullback. And I mean, again, yeah, you look at Ryan Yesley over at Valor. That's one that I'm keeping a very close eye on. It's the fact that he's already trying with or having that training stint with Ajaccio just kind of adds to the excitement that I have for him next year, just because he's someone who impressed me a lot last year. And I'm going to be keeping an eye on him. But yeah, those are some of the names just rolling through the list.
And another question from Michael Rice at Mike Rice 1983. As the CPL continues to expand, when looking at new teams, how important is building rivalries as much as reaching new markets? Will the new rivalry of Pacific versus Vancouver be big for its growth?
Yes, especially if both teams are competitive, because I think one of the downsides of El Clasico is that Edmonton has been a bit of a tire fire, right? I mean, when they were both relatively competitive, the games were entertaining, they were fiery, but look at Calgary versus Forge and how, first of all, how tactically incredible those games have been with Tommy Wealdon Jr. and Bobby Smyrniotis doing battle, just the back and forth, all the, you know, controversy, the red cards, all that stuff. I do think that it is important having those regionalized rivalries, just because you want to obviously target the local fan bases. You want to appeal to them first and then work your way outside of those regions. And the best way to do that is by developing those rivalries, or one of the best ways to do it is by developing those rivalries. So for sure, that is going to be very important.
And I think that that's very important, that it is a competitive rivalry and both clubs are playing at a high level, because if you have a rivalry where one club is at a high level and one club is not, and it's just absolute dominance, well, then you get what you had in El Clasico, and you don't want that. But if you have two clubs that are near middling in the standings or near the bottom, well, that's not going to be too interesting either. So you need clubs that are playing for something, but you also need clubs that do hate each other and have that rivalry. But from Mark Carveo at IggyFan2001, any insight into why Jordan Wilson retired? He's not particularly young, but he's not too old either. And I feel like he was pretty effective for York last season.
Yeah, I don't really like have any real insight other than it could be a variety of factors that has led to many CPL players retiring maybe earlier than you might expect, and that they might want to pursue other opportunities. Maybe it's financial, maybe it's, you know, we just don't really know. From the sound of it, it seems like Jordan Wilson wanted to pursue other opportunities, and that's fair enough. Like, he did relatively well on One Soccer whenever he appeared. So maybe he wants to see maybe more a media career or do something along those lines, right? It could also be that, you know, maybe York was just going another direction, and, you know, because we know how much they'd like to prioritize the youth, and maybe he put two and two together and thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll step away. But we can't really say for sure yet, because he never really gave specific reasons from what I saw.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly going to be a loss in midfield for York. I mean, he played as well, had step in at center back, etc. But yeah, I mean, it's someone we're not particularly old, but you're in your 30s. He also, you know, he's got kids, so it's something where it's like, okay, you know, a lot of travel, especially in the CPL. It's not, you know, it's not like when you're playing in Europe where most nights you're back in your own bed. There's these road trips where you're gone for weeks at a time. It's never easy when you have young children as well. And it's one where, okay, maybe you get this chance to pursue other opportunities that make a lot of sense for you. You're at a certain age, you've got kids, it kind of all just kind of adds up. So certainly one where, you know, York's going to lose a bit of that experience, especially for a young team, but you know, a fair decision for him to take. And, you know, it's one we've seen a few CPL players, you know, make that decision where at a certain age, it's, you know, just might not be, you know, worth some of the things that come along with the pro game. Because obviously the pro game, it's great. You make money, you play soccer, you get to live the dream on that aspect. But when you got other things going on, sometimes it can be hard to balance the dream, especially when you're at a, you know, certain level.
And from AP at A Pug in the Park, if you were to pick a young Canadian to start an expansion CPL team with, who would it be?
Yeah, so I maybe just as a qualifier, let's keep this to like current CPL players or recently departed even, CPL players.
I'd say anyone. How about anyone that's likely to be in the league next year? So you could use like a Ronan Kratt because he's technically under contract, but we'll cut out like the Isaiah Johnstons, who would have been my pick if he was still around, just because that kind of...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough pick. I'm going to go with an easy one. Osase de Rosario, just based on how much he sort of dominated in attack, right? He was averaging basically a goal every other game, or at least a, what was it, 0.5 goals per 90 last time I checked, you know, towards the end of the last season, and had about 0.4 expected goals per 90. And if you take away penalties and all that, I think he was still like at 0.35, which for a 21-year-old making his debut in the league, pretty damn solid. So I'm going to go with him, especially given how well-rounded he is as well, not just with the goal scoring, but the fact he can hold up plays, an aerial threat, and having that prolific number nine can really help you when you're an expansion team.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the names, I feel like it's kind of take your pick between like the likes of Di Rosario, Passius, throw Ronan Kratt into that mix in terms of forward options. If I were going to answer the question, just because I'd usually like to, when I hear the words build my team, in my ideal world, you build your team and then you throw your striker in last. So I'd probably throw in, I'd maybe look more for names like a, you know, Kwasi Poku or Sean Young or like a Cedric Toussaint style player. So you really solidify the midfield or go from there. Or I'd go Christian Campagna. Shocker. Just because.
Shocker. So, Alex going with the midfielder.
Hey, you got to show some love for midfield. Midfield wins football matches. That's meeting I live and die by. But if not, I'll go also center backs do also win matches. So Christian Campagna is one I'd also throw in the hat, and he'd arguably be my first pick. Honestly, I'd say Christian Campagna, just given his age, his profile, everything he saw. I'll pick Christian Campagna straight up.
Elsewhere, League One Alberta could be coming to fruition soon, per a report from Northern Tribune. They say that there's a serious aim to start League One Alberta in 2024, and an exhibition series is expected this summer, including five Albertan clubs. And a question from Matt Paternostra at Matt Paternostra. Compare the structure of U Sports soccer and NCAA soccer and what U Sports should do to grow more popular. A simple question, but a loaded one at that, in terms of how U Sports should grow more popular. And I think it really starts with the media attention and the effective communications from U Sports itself. I think there has to be more publicity about the league and where it can go and what it produces. And there's there needs to be regular content produced around U Sports. And that's something that I've been trying to do over the last several years between my work with 49 Sports, my work with CBC Sports, and right here on this podcast where I try and bring it up as much as possible. I just think people need to talk about it and it needs to be at the front of people's minds, or at least in people's minds, because it happens. And a lot of the time it's just the status quo and people will just go along with it. The competitions happen and there's not really any attention that goes towards it. I think it's just putting a bit of attention towards it and then people will follow. And I've been able to prove that, and it's proven that people will follow if there is the attention towards it and those stories are being told. And I think that both of you and myself have done a good job to try and tell those stories of U Sports soccer and the collegiate level in this country. But when you take a look at the NCAA and how it compares to U Sports soccer, the big difference is in U Sports, you don't have full ride scholarships. There's not a single athlete in Canadian university soccer that is on a full ride scholarship at their school. Sure, some will have scholarships, but you can't have a scholarship above $5,000, and they're known as athletic financial awards. I could go on about how it works in U Sports, but the big difference is you're not going to get those same facilities a lot of the time. You're not going to get the full ride scholarships. You're not going to get the professional draft possibilities like you have in the States with the NWSL. The NCAA is a behemoth of college sports. It's as large as a lot of professional leagues in the world. It's almost larger than a lot of professional leagues in the world. And U Sports soccer, unfortunately, is not at that level, but is an incredible level of play. And any athlete that utmost respect for providing Canada with that level of development. That's my little rant on U Sports soccer versus NCAA soccer. I could go on. Feel free to DM me on Twitter. I'm always happy to chat about that.
One thing I'll add as well, from what I've seen of U Sports, just feels like they also kind of have to improve, I guess, a mix of marketing, match day experience, and just promotion. Because the thing is, the level's good. Having a chance to see, you know, commentate U Sports with Ben, we commentated York games, you know, having seen UBC when I'm in BC, et cetera, seeing some of these levels, you see the Nationals as well, watching that one was on CBC. The level is good. You look at some of these players where they've been able to step up to. Of course, there's a countless examples like your Joel Watermans, like your Victor Latouris. You look at players stepping constantly into lineups. Like, there's some good players. Some of these top players could easily play in NCAA. Some of them have played in NCAA, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just, you don't really hear about them. One thing I noticed about the match day experience, it just feels like these match days, they come at you. Even like other sports, you almost hear about these games. Like, oh, you know, the hockey team's playing, you know, this sort of stuff. But for the soccer team, it's kind of an afterthought in that regard. There isn't really promoted. There isn't this whole match day experience. And there have been some cities who've pulled it off. You look at Quebec, for example, and, you know, how people support the University of Montreal, the Carabins. Like, they get ultras, they get smoke, fans are interested, fans know their player. That's an example of, you know, a team promoting itself, promoting its players, promoting its experience, and it looks fun. It's an atmosphere where that comes together. Whereas a lot of U Sports teams, the soccer team is an equivalent of just an athletics that they have to have. It's like a swim meet, which, again, a lot of respect to swimmers out there, but it's not an event where people are showing up and really having a huge fan experience over swimming. Whereas soccer, as we know, is a very fan-driven sport. It's a sport with a lot of fan experience where there's a lot of times it's not reflected. It's just an event. Teams will show up, they'll have five fans, which are usually their parents, and I think that's too bad because the level of talent on display doesn't really fit that mold. So I think just promoting, really showing that there's a level of athlete, showing, just really promoting an experience where come to the game, enjoy the game. It's not just, you know, athletic obligation that the university has to fill, will also go a long way. Schools that do that have done well. You see again last year UBC, when they really promoted that homecoming game for their women's soccer team, and they had like 4,000 fans there. It looked like a good time. It was a great little game, and you just wonder, why can't teams really push that sort of experience on a more regular basis?
If you want to just put it simply, it's advertising communication that these events are happening. It's not necessarily even the level. You can take a bad U Sports team and advertise it well. But as Alex said, these events tend to just come and go like it's a swim meet. Of course, swimming with Olympians, I could go into that as well. But with hockey, with soccer, it just comes down to marketing. And there's some schools that do a fantastic job, some that needs a lot of work. And I think there's definitely progress being made on a national level. But it's just knowing that these things are happening and knowing that there's an event to go to that is the issue right now. But moving on to our last question of the day from Kula at Kula1087. Where is Thomas Neff?
I'll try to answer this as candidly as I can without potentially gaslighting Thomas here. As Alex takes a massive sip from his water, sits back and waits for me to fully explain it here. So look, around October, it became apparent that leaning into the World Cup, the podcast was going to get some opportunities financially or otherwise, that was going to lead to just more time and commitment on everybody's end, right? And essentially, I proposed this to Thomas. And keep in mind as well, before this, as some of you guys know, we were sponsored by DraftKings. We had, I think, two different engagements with them in 2022. But other than that, we were pretty much doing this on our own time, just out of pure passion and desire, because we loved Canadian soccer. We saw that the listenership was growing every week, and we wanted to put on the best possible product we could because there was a gap in the market. Nobody else was doing a general Canadian soccer podcast, and we wanted to keep pushing that. So once the World Cup was approaching, more opportunities started to arise. And look, simply put, Thomas and I had a bit of a disagreement just in terms of the future direction of the show. He couldn't commit more time to it, which is totally fair enough because Thomas is actually planning some big personal things for himself in 2023. And I respected that. And we're still on good terms. We're still good friends. The split was amicable. It was a bittersweet decision because, look, Thomas is the guy that I did start the show with. And we did have some good times on the show. And there was some of my best memories covering soccer in this country over the last couple of years involved Thomas, but a decision had to be made one way or the other. It's done. We're more than happy to have been aboard now. He's been tremendous since he stepped in, especially right at the busiest time in Canadian soccer. And we're thrilled to have you on, Ben, by the way. Like, you know, take nothing away from that, but that is the situation, just so everybody kind of puts it to bed. Thomas and I are talking about him maybe coming on the show briefly and saying one final goodbye, maybe telling his side of it, but just to be as candid as possible, because we owe the listeners that much. That is the situation with Thomas.
And for those who don't know me, I have a broadcasting background. I've known Alex and Peter for a few years now, and it was a pleasure to jump on this show and be hosting the show alongside you too. I know that my soccer knowledge is not necessarily up to the level of Peter and Alex. Definitely a little bit more multi-sport.
Don't patronize yourself.
But it's a pleasure to be on here and a pleasure to help.
You watch a lot of footy.
Canadian soccer. But that will do it for episode 105 of the Northern Football Podcast. For myself, Ben Steiner, for Peter Galindo, for Alex, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week for episode 106 as 2023 continues to move along in Canadian soccer. Remember to rate us on wherever you're listening to your podcast, and also feel free to engage with us on Twitter at Alex Gonge Ruzic, at Galindo PW, and at Ben Steiner 00. A pleasure to be here. Thanks to you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for bringing me on the podcast as well at the busiest time of Canadian soccer. We'll be back next week.